hello and welcome to M. Night Frights, the Talk Film Society podcast celebrating the genre films of Manoj Nellyattu Shyamalan, a.k.a. M. Night Shyamalan. I'm your host, Manish Mathur, staff writer at Talk Film Society. This episode, I'm talking about M. Night's 2015 found footage horror film, The Visit, starring Olivia De Jong, Ed Oxenbould, Deanna Dunigan, Peter McRobbie, and the phenomenal Catherine Hahn. I'm joined today by the staff writer at Award Circuit, Karen Peterson. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm really excited to talk about this movie for a number of reasons. One is I just got through The Last Airbender and After Earth, so this is a nice return to M. Night being... Yeah, it's nice to see M. Night back on his A game. After those two missteps. Actually, it's been a number of weeks of missteps. But I just wanted to hear, like, what's your favorite M. Night Shyamalan film?
I cannot answer that question, honestly. Every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, I love Signs. Oh, no, but I really love Unbreakable. And I don't... I can't pick a favorite. I really can't. I haven't seen Last Airbender or After Earth. I just kind of skipped those because, you know, to me, those aren't really M. Night Shyamalan movies. Those are studio movies. And right. It's just not the same thing. So I haven't felt the need to check those out. But all the others, I even like the ones that nobody else likes. I enjoy Lady in the Water, although it's been a long time since I've watched it, and I can't really remember why I liked it so much. But The Visit is another one that I love, so I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, me too. I love this film a lot. In fact, I would put it probably in my top five M. Night films if I had to rank them, or at least maybe in the top two. Like, I for me, The Sixth Sense is a really special film, but I really, really enjoy The Visit, and I watched it again this weekend, and I found it to be just as, you know, delightful and interesting and well-made. Yeah, the film, you know, follows two teenagers, Becca and Tyler, played by Olivia De Jong and Ed Oxenbould, and they convince their mom to let them visit their grandparents, her parents, for a week. And they're a little hesitant, she's a little hesitant because she hasn't spoken to them in a number of years because of an... sort of a fight that they had about her getting married or running away with her substitute teacher. And so they go visit the grandparents and start to notice strange things happening around the house, and that the grandparents are acting very odd and a little frightening. But Becca, the older of the two siblings, you know, reassures her brother that it's just, you know, people getting old, and just it's just how things are when you're at that age. And so what I find really interesting about The Visit is that the horror doesn't really come from anything supernatural like ghosts or aliens or anything like that, but rather just being with elderly people whose bodies are kind of betraying them at that age, and it's a kind of an interesting concept for a horror film.
Yeah, what I like about this one, and really all of his horror films, is the fact that the horror element is really just more of the vehicle that he tells his story with, but that's not really ever what his movies are about. At the center of this one in particular, it's a family drama. You've got this woman who, you know, ran off with this guy that was cute. I had a really cute substitute teacher in high school I might have considered, but, you know, like, and then this causes this huge family rift. And so for 15 years, she doesn't see her parents. That guy that she ran off with ends up leaving the family and leaving her with two children. And it's, you know, so she's made the best of it, and she's got two great kids. But she still, even when her parents reach out to her, she still just can't bring herself to bridge that, you know, to come back to them. And so that's what I think is so great about this film. Like, there's a lot of horror stuff that happens, and a lot of it is, you know, the campy side of horror, and it's really fun, but that's not ultimately what the movie's about.
I really like that this film takes the family aspects of it very seriously. And that, you know, you have both kids are dealing with their own personal issues regarding their dad leaving. Tyler is a germaphobe and he is, you know, terrified of getting dirty and things like that. And Becca is dealing with, I think, self-esteem, and she doesn't like to look at herself in the mirror. And it's nice to see, you know, the effects of that traumatic experience on these kids and how they deal with it, and how this week with their grandparents helps them to overcome those things. And yeah, I find the kids really fun to watch. I mean, they're both very obnoxious in a somewhat believable, fun way. You know, Becca is very pretentious about her filmmaking. Tyler has this like weird rapping thing, which is very cringeworthy.
Yeah, but you know, that's the thing. Like, at that age, especially that middle school age, because I have a nephew who's 13, and they come up with the weirdest things when they're trying to assert themselves and decide what their identity is going to be and what they're going to put out into the world. And so, yeah, it's completely weird. It's completely cringeworthy. Some of the stuff that he says, it's like, oh my gosh, kid, what are you doing? But it's also, it makes it realistic that it's so bad and weird. Because 13-year-old boys are weird.
At the heart of it, though, like, he's a good kid. You know, they're both, like, really good kids. They're both very, like, sweet and caring, which... So something that I have noticed, you know, with M. Night's films, especially when he works with children, is that he doesn't show children in a bad light, in the sense that, like, he doesn't rarely has, like, straight up, like, bratty kids or annoying kids. Like, usually the children in his films, like, especially, you know, Haley Joel Osment and The Sixth Sense and these two, I found it really touching this time around that they are both very encouraging of their mom to, like, go on her cruise. And I like that they're encouraging her to, like, live a life and have fun and, like, be with her boyfriend. Like, it's just, like, want to go on this trip with their, to see their grandparents, because, like, they want to repair the rift between, you know, their mom and her parents.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing, like, you see, I mean, like you're saying, all the kids that he's had in protagonist roles, I mean, obviously there's been, like, that other kid in The Sixth Sense that was a total brat, you know.
Oh, yeah,
but he's not a main, but he's not a main part of that story.
Right.
And so, but we all deal with people like that in life, and especially as kids. But yeah, like, the kids that he has in protagonist roles, the kids in Signs, the two teenagers here, they're also not just, like, these perfect angels, either. They talk back, they swear, they, you know, they do all kinds of things that kids do. And I really like that. He gives something, they're a little bit on the side of being, you know, kind of Mary Sue types, but...
Sure.
They're more rounded than that. They're more fleshed out than that.
It's so interesting to, you know, read M. Night's interviews or watch his interviews. He always talks about his own children and his relationship with his parents. And so I find it really, really kind of charming that comes through in his work. And he offers, you know, kid actors, like, well-rounded characters to play who are interesting and proactive and... make choices that make sense for that age, even if they're not, like, the best choices. But yeah, I really liked the two teens in the film. What did you think about the grandparents themselves? Like, how, like, did you find them scary or funny or just strange?
I think that they're supposed to feel like they're just strange and weird. And if you think about it from the point of view of a 13-year-old who's never met these people and suddenly he's going to stay at their house for a week of his own choice, like, he's not being roped into this at all. But, you know, when you're not used to being around older people, you don't know what to expect. And one thing that you were saying in the beginning that I kind of slightly disagree. I mean, ultimately, in the end, we find out what really is going on. But one of the things that I love about the way that this story unfolds is you don't actually know. Like, are the grandparents possessed? Are they just old and weird? Is there something else going on here? Is there something supernatural? Because then, like, the grandma starts telling that story about the pond, and the grandpa starts telling the story about that white shape at work. And so it's like, it's done in such a way that, as, you know, from a kid perspective, you're not really sure what's happening. And that's, I think that's one of the brilliant things about the way that he tells this story, is that even as an adult watching it from a kid's eyes, And so you're kind of trying to just accept their explanation for things, but at the same time, you're still questioning it a little bit because it's weird, and you're not, you just don't know what to expect, and you don't know what's really going on.
Right. You know, I did forget to mention that this is a spoiler podcast, so, you know, we, so the listeners, like, we will be going through the whole, to the whole story with all the twists and turns. So if you haven't seen The Visit, please press pause, watch the film. It's really incredible, and then come back. So yeah, we can talk about, you know, the full story. I actually find The Visit to be a great twist movie, because the twist is so obvious that the first time I saw it, I completely even dismissed that the people that they're with aren't the real grandparents at all. I'm like, that's just so, it's so obvious that I think I'm not able to do something even more, you know, lavish to, or outlandish to top himself. But I actually find that that's such a natural twist, and he does it really well. And the fact that the twist happens and there's like about like 20 minutes left in the film for the characters to like react to it and have the full climax, and it really ups the tension. It kind of, it reminds me a lot of like Hitchcock's work, which is, you know, you reveal the twist and then let the film bake in it for, you know, the final act.
Yeah, it's not just like, oh, surprise, this is what's been really going on, roll credits. It's no, we're going to find out what's happening and then react to it and experience this and go through that mental process of it. I think that with, because this twist in this one actually reminded me a little bit of the way that he did The Sixth Sense, mm-hmm. where when you go back and watch it, it's super obvious what's right. going on. You're so focused on what you're seeing that you're missing all the hints that are along the way, because like in this movie, you know, there are all these references to this mental hospital where the grandparents have been volunteering. And even in the very beginning, Mom is saying, Catherine Hahn, she's talking about them and how she looked them up after they reached out to her. And she kind of gets a laugh about the fact that they're volunteering as counselors.
Right.
Like, that just seems odd to her. And so that what should be something that like, oh, I need to pay attention to the fact that they're doing this work, but it's done in such a way that you just kind of move right past it. You don't even notice. And then when people from the hospital start showing up and it just happens that grandma and grandpa aren't around, every time these people show up, nobody's there to identify who they are and to say that's not who it's supposed to be. And it's really well done.
Yeah, I really like the scene where the lady comes over with the cake or the... Mm-hmm. you know, the dish, and to thank them, and she's, you know, she does end up talking to them, and you don't hear the conversation, but you can kind of, I think that he shoots it from inside the house through the window, and yeah, it's a good little, like, suspense scene, because you're kind of wondering, like, why she's talking to them so heatedly, and what the issue is, and then, you know, End Night plants a really, like, striking, horrifying shot of her hanging, and after they've killed her. And it's, I mean, it's a really spooky, like part of the film, because like when, I think it's like really the first time that we got like a major reveal that like, not only are they not the grandparents, but they're like violent and like, you know, and possibly in killers.
Yeah, like, this isn't just a weird situation the kids have walked into. This is something that is very dangerous,
yeah.
And they could die.
So, like, I can buy the whole idea that every time people come to the house, like, they're just not around. Like, that's a very simple horror movie thing. Like, I'm cool with that. But in the beginning, I think M. Night does a lot of legwork to not have Catherine Hahn drop them off at the house. And I find it just a little bit of a stretch that that she won't go to see them. Like, I understand the like emotional reason why, but I can sort of see his like puppet strings in the beginning setting up this whole situation. But I again, like, after 10 minutes of them at the house, like, that doesn't bother me at all, and I am totally absorbed in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, he does set that up in a very specific way, because not only, I mean, she doesn't just not go because of her emotional issues and the fact that they have never patched things up. It's also, oh, they also live really far away and she's leaving on a cruise that night. And so there's these very convenient things. I agree with you. It is a little contrived, but I also didn't mind that because it's just a fun, you know, way to enter into this story. And also there's no story if mom drops them
off. No, yeah, of course. Like that, I mean, again, like I don't, it's not that it like it really bothers me, but I think there might have been a little bit more of an artful way to get there, rather than make it so, like, such a very specific situation that they have to go to the house, you know, by themselves.
Yeah.
I do really like this film as a horror comedy. It's a really goofy B-movie. Like, it feels very campy in ways. So it, like, has a really good balance of, like, really scary moments and really funny moments. And so, I really like that this film achieves the tone that I think M. Night was going for with, you know, with The Happening. I think that this movie really, he really does that pretty well and has a nice balance. And it's especially with the concept of sundowning, which is where people with Alzheimer's, their symptoms are more exacerbated at night, which is real, but I think it's probably a little bit taken to the extreme, you know, in the film. But I like that because it keeps the kids a little off balance because they don't really know whether, like, what's happening at night is anything more than just normal, like, this, like, standard Alzheimer's symptoms, or if there's something even a little bit more dangerous going on. And then the grandparents are normal-ish in the daytime, you know, they're still a little strange. And there's always some kind of logical conclusion that the kids have or receive from the grandparents. Like, for example, the fact that the grandfather has to use, like, adult diapers, you know, that's kind of explained away in his paranoia. It's explained away to the kids that makes sense. So even if they're scared, they're still somewhat aware that it's not anything too dangerous until it's revealed that it actually is very dangerous there.
Right. Well, but that's one of the reasons that it has to be teenagers and young, mm-hmm. young teenagers, because as adults, if we walked into that situation, we'd be like, no, this isn't okay. These explanations aren't enough. You have to have something where you've got kids that are willing to, because they want this all to be great. They want this visit to go well. They want their mom to reconcile with their grandparents and have this relationship. And so they're wanting to believe these things, and they're young enough that these odd explanations do make enough sense that they're just going to accept it. Well, I think one of the other things that makes it easier to accept these weird things that are going on is, even though this is the first time that they've ever met these people, it's such a normal grandparent visit, you know? They've never seen them. Becca's 15. She was born right after her parents took off. And so instead of, like, we're going to spend every last minute of our time with you because we've never seen you before and we have a lot of questions, it's totally normal. You know, when I used to go visit my grandparents, it was like, my brother and I would hang out and play games while my grandparents are out doing yard work or walking in the neighborhood or visiting neighbors or whatever. They weren't 100% with us all the time. And so it does lend this very, you know, it feels normal. It doesn't feel like something that is a very unusual experience, I guess, which I think lulls you, or at least lulls the kids, into this false sense of security that that they're willing to accept, even though these weird things are happening, it's not anything to worry about.
Yeah, and I really like the hook of, you know, don't leave your room after 9:30, because I just find that to be really, it's like a really brilliant way of, again, like you said, it's like balancing the sort of like mundane thing of like, yeah, like I guess, you know, grandparents wouldn't want, you know, kids running around like at night while they're trying to go to sleep, especially if they're falling victim to like sundowning. Maybe it's like an old house, so they can be really loud. So they want to keep the kids in there. But also there's that sense of like danger. And I really like that this movie is fairy tale allegories. You know, of course, there's the Hansel and Gretel thing, you know, with the grandmother asking Becca to go into the oven, which when I saw that in the trailer, and I really, really loved that. I thought it was great. Little, like, spooky, funny thing. And it happens, like, it happens in the film a couple times, and it gets scarier each time, actually.
What's great about that particular thing, and it's funny because I've actually heard different people respond differently to the, particularly to the oven, because nothing ends up happening. And so I've heard some people say that that was really just a big buildup for nothing. But to me, that's actually even more brilliant because, again, we're watching this, we're experiencing this as teenagers. We're not experiencing this movie as adults. Yeah. We're watching this through the kids' eyes. And so that buildup is really what's the scary part of it. It's not what happens. And Grandma doesn't do that to threaten the kids. She does it because she's having fun and she's trying to deflect their attention from something else.
Right.
Like the first time, it's because she doesn't want to sit down for this interview. And so she's using it as a distraction. And then the second time, same thing. She's just trying to, like, take the conversation in a different direction.
Yeah.
And it's another one of those elements where it feels like it's one thing, but it's actually something else.
Yeah, and then there's also a sort of a comparison to Little Red Riding Hood, you know, especially, you know, with the grandmother getting eaten in the fairy tale and then replaced by, like, the wolf, and that it's very similar to what happens here. So, you know, M. Night is kind of operating on this level of making this kind of found footage version of a modern fairy tale. And again, it's a more successful version of what he tried to do in Lady in the Water, where that was also trying to be a fairy tale that was, like, mixed in with, like, horror, science fiction type thing. And so, yeah, I like that he is able to make these connections in a more, you know, fun, artful way. And I'm glad you brought up the interview, actually, because I wanted to talk about, I think, my favorite scene in the film, which is when Grandma does allow Becca to sit down for the interview. And it's a nice little scene where she tries to get the grandmother to open up by framing the events of the family past through, like, another story. Like, oh, imagine if this girl, you know, XYZ. So I like that little bit of screenwriting. I thought that was a really, really well-written scene from M. Night. And a really, again, like, tying into this whole fairy tale thing of making everything, like, a story. I like that a lot.
Well, it also allows a really beautiful bit of acting from Deanna Dunnigan, who plays Nana. Because that entire, everything that Becca's saying, she's off camera and you're only seeing Nana, Grandma, react to it. And I love when actors are able to just do so much without saying anything, without even really moving. You see so much just crossing their face, and you know exactly what they're feeling and what they're thinking. And it's really great work there from the camera angle as well as Deanna Dunnigan.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of seeing her on Broadway in August, Osage County, I think back in, I want to say 2008 or 2009. Immediately, I recognized her name when I saw that she was in The Visit, and I was so excited because she was, I mean, she won a Tony for that performance. It was a great, great piece of acting from her. I mean, it's like basically 3 hours of her in like a downward spiral. Actually, not too dissimilar from this, although that's obviously less murdery and less violent, but yeah, it was a great,
a little bit.
Yeah, it was great. And actually, I wanted to get your thoughts about the film as found footage. Like, are you a fan of found footage horror films in general, or like what are the, like, what do you think about his choice to do that?
I think it totally depends. Sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it does not work at all. And I think that it works here for a couple of reasons. Again, this is really putting this in the perspective of, you know, a 15-year-old kid telling this story because everything is from her point of view. And she's looking at and reacting to things the right way. And one of the ways that this is a little bit better of a found footage film than, say, like the Blair Witch Project is that they use additional cameras. It's not just one single camera.
Yes, yes.
So that's actually a really good thing. And then also the cinematography was done by Maurice Alberti, who's just incredible and should have Oscar nominations by now.
Yeah.
But that's another conversation. But I think that because of her work, that the cinematography in this, even though it is that found footage, she's finding good angles that really work, and this doesn't feel like some jolty student thing. And yeah. So I think that that's why it works so well.
And for me, it also is helped by the fact that Becca is framing this as a documentary. So it's not like, oh, we found this footage of these two kids. It's like, no, they're like editing right. it and they're trying to, they want to make it into a finished film. So that makes it a little easier to understand why they're recording something that you wouldn't record. Like, because that's always sure, my hang yeah. up with found footage. It's like, at the end of the day, like, I get it. Like, it's a movie, like, and they have to record because it's the movie. But I hardly ever find that found footage movies, like, justify why their characters are recording. And here, it makes sense. Like, they want, they're using this, the documentary to repair this relationship, so they want to see it through. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, using the multiple cameras, mm-hmm. and then also having, like, mom on Skype and using some of that through the webcam and stuff. So this is actually kind of a bridge between something like a Blair Witch or a Cloverfield and Searching, which came out this year.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's using kind of both types of found footage, which makes it a fuller experience, I think.
Yeah, that's a great connection, Searching. I hadn't thought of that. I'm glad you brought up Maryse Alberti. I was really impressed with her work in this film. I had never really... I guess I had seen Velvet Goldmine, but I didn't make the connection that that was her. And then this was the same year as Creed, which came out a couple of months after The Visit. And that was just a phenomenally shot film. And yeah, I liked her use of her angles and being able to capture, like, almost an entire room with the camera and, you know, choosing to shoot on someone with the other person in the scene, like, off camera. I always love when movies do that. And the natural light in the film also gave it a very eerie tone, you know, with this, like, very harsh winter look. I really liked her work on the film, and this is kind of the first time that M. Night is using a cinematographer who is a little less well known. I mean, he usually works with, you know, Oscar nominated and very influential cinematographers like Tak Fujimoto or Christopher Doyle. So it's cool to see him work with a cinematographer who is a little lesser known, whose, like, tricks are a little harder to grasp, because it makes the film a little bit more surprising. Yeah, I mean, M. Night probably had to work with a lesser-known cinematographer because this film costs so little. It's cost about $5 million. And M. Night had basically funded the film himself. I think after the failures of his last, I don't know, four films, I think he was looking for a palate cleanser, and he just put up the money himself. I believe he pitched the script to a few studios, and I don't think anyone was really willing to touch it. So he decided to just co-finance it himself, finance it himself. And then he shopped a few different cuts around. He said that he had a cut that was, like, all horror, one that was all comedy, and one which was a combination of the two. And I believe that's the final cut that we have. I think he was, like, shopping that around, and he landed at Jason Blum through Blumhouse, and I think he and Blum both liked each other's models, and now they've been working together, you know, the next three films with M. Night would be released through Universal and Jason Blum, The Visit, Split, and the upcoming Glass. I really find it cool that this movie was financed by M. Night himself. I mean, he really put his financials on the line with it. And I believe he said he used his salary from After Earth to make it. So I found that pretty cool.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the reasons that he agreed to do After Earth, is because that was really, you know, in a lot of ways, that was kind of to collect a paycheck so that he could keep doing what he really loves.
Yeah.
And you can't fault the guy for that. You know, he does want to... He has a specific style and a very specific voice, and he, you know, I like the fact that he gets to have final cut on his films, and I like the fact that he gets to just make what he wants, and it doesn't always work out. They're not all, you know, perfect movies, but there's something ultra watchable about pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
And I think that he and Jason Blum are a good pair because of Blum's model, where he's like, make the movie you want to make and I'll help get it out there. And so they're a great pair.
The Blumhouse model of using very low budget sense to like get a better profit works well with M. Night, because I think when he has too much money, like The Happening or Lady in the Water, or of course Last Airbender and After Earth, which went, their budgets went into the hundreds, he can get lost in his own, in the whole process of handling a budget that big. So, you know, with, you know, The Visit costing $5 million, like it really kept him in line. And I think that works well with the Blumhouse model. And of course, this movie was very, very successful relative to the budget. The film was released in September of 2015. It opened at number two with $25 million. So it was already five times its budget opening weekend. And it went on to gross $33 million overseas for a total of about $98 million. So he didn't quite crack 100, but considering the movie was so cheap, $98 million, you know, return was very good for him. And I think what is more important, that this movie got pretty solid reviews. I think it was about 65% on Rotten Tomatoes, something like that. So it wasn't, you know, critically acclaimed, but it definitely had positive reaction. And I think that's really important, because it was like, okay, well, now M. Night is back. You know, now his name isn't really associated as a joke as it had been for the last almost a decade. So it's kind of, this movie was a bit of a comeback. I think fully he would arrive as like a major force in, you know, in the next couple of years with Split. But I think The Visit was a definite step in the right direction. And the movie has its fans, like the two of us. I really like the Visit. I'm glad that it was, you know, a step forward for M. Night and allowed him to get some collateral back so he can continue with his Unbreakable trilogy.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly right. I think because of The Visit, Split and ultimately Glass were allowed to happen. Mm-hmm. And who knows if that ever would have come about if it hadn't been for this one. But one of the things about M. Night Shyamalan is that I wonder if it's him or if it's the audience, because, you know, there's this concept of chasing the phenomenon. You saw that with Michael Jackson after Thriller. Like, everything he did after that, he was trying to make it as big as Thriller. You see George Lucas constantly tinkering with Star Wars, or J.K. Rowling, who won't leave Harry Potter alone.
Oh, God.
And yeah, and so you see these things happen with people who nail something really well that everyone loves, and then they spend the rest of their career trying to chase that again. And I think that M. Night Shyamalan hasn't necessarily done that. I mean, his first big movie is The Sixth Sense, which is, you know, a phenomenal movie, and for a lot of reasons. And everyone's expecting every movie that comes after that to be The Sixth Sense, and they're never going to be. There's such a perfect storm that came together for that to exist. And this is where I don't know if it's him that's always trying to do something that's going to be on that level, or if it's just people expecting him to. And so The Visit getting 65% is, you know, it, on one hand, that may look disappointing, but on another, it's like, no, this is actually probably about right for a filmmaker like him, because most of his movies are not gonna ever be The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
They're something a little smaller, and that's good, and that's fine, and that's that there's room for that. And he needs to be allowed to make those movies.
I think that's a great place to end, unless you have any other final thoughts about The Visit or M. Night Shyamalan himself.
Just that I love The Visit. I think it's a lot of fun. And M. Night Shyamalan is honestly one of my favorite filmmakers, because of the fact that he just tries what he likes, and he makes the films that he wants to make.
Yeah, totally with you there. So Karen, where can people find you online?
Oh, I am everywhere. the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. I'm at Karen M. Peterson. And there I link to my work at awardcircuit.com. I'm also on the Citizen Name podcast and the Watch and Talk podcast.
Yes, I highly recommend that you listen to Citizen Dame, especially. It's a really funny podcast. I really enjoy it.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89. And at Talk Film Society, where you can read my writing there. Next week, I'm going to be tackling M. Night Shyamalan's most successful comeback film, Split. Stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening. Bye.